After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
It all depends on which veil, how you're looking at the world around you. And until you feel safe, you can't open your heart to other people. And you only feel safe when you've cultivated that part of yourself which is not vulnerable, which isn't just your separateness. As long as you think you are only your separateness, you are doomed to fear and anxiety all the time, if only the fear of death.
Welcome, everyone, to another Ram Dass Here and Now episode. This is number 246, How to Be Responsive, Not Reactive. And don't we all need that from time to time, especially in these times where everything seems really inflammatory? If you don't know me, I'm Jackie Dobrinska, the host, and you all are this incredible Ram Dass community from around the world. Thank you for tuning in. This episode is a continuation of the last one, which was a lecture in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1987. Maybe you think of Ram Dass and his awakening originally through the psychedelic experiences that sort of opened him to these other planes of himself. But in this episode, he gives example after example of these everyday experiences. Well, not quite everyday experiences, but they're the relationships that helped him wake up in a similar way, you know, to wake up to those places beyond our roles and those habituated beliefs and thought forms and forms, and into this other part of ourself that is expanded and present and in communion with what is, that sort of intuitive heart, that place that the Sufi and Christian mystics wrote poems about, and that place that I think most of us long for in a deep way. So if you are a longtime listener, you have heard many of these stories, perhaps many times. I sort of want to call this episode Storytime with Ram Dass, or Ram Dass's Greatest Hits, and then dedicate it to some sweet, long-lost love. They are oldies but goodies and always worth revisiting because you catch something new each time. I know I did when listening to these for probably the 30th time. So a quick teaser. He starts with a poignant example of how suffering, though we don't wish it on ourselves or anyone, how it can be this like incredible, skillful means to break down our ego so that we can drop into that expanded or experience that expanded version of who we really are. He tells two of his favorite stories about how his guru blew his mind and how that led to this experience of unconditional love that was a catalyst to, again, expand beyond what they call samskaras or vasanas in the yoga tradition, beyond the ways we hold ourselves. He shares a couple more stories about these really special beings who helped him release that I-ness that we're often caught in and drop in to that sweet communion. And then another couple stories about letting go of our expectations and the way we box ourselves and others in, how we're caught by that constant flow of thoughts, and simply relish in what's happening, even if it's boredom or discomfort. And in that tapping in, there is a sweetness, even a bliss. And then he ends with what I think might be like my favorite story of all time. It might be getting made into a movie. I don't know. I'm not going to say anything more about it, except that one of the things I like to do is listen to it as if I was each of the characters, because it brings a different perspective. So in listening to this episode, it makes me wonder, you know, what life events are happening to each of us that are helping us to break out of our conditioning and limited selves. Maybe it's breakups or love affairs or births or deaths, or maybe it's really simple interactions we overlook every day. I recently had one. It was one of the more dramatic ones. I say I died, and it's a dramatic and fun way of saying that I went through this death contemplation as part of this direct care training at the Conscious Center for Living and Dying here in Asheville, North Carolina. It was executed so incredibly well by the facilitator. The whole room was crying. And in our different ways, we all dropped form. And for me, it led to this really real experience of merging into expansiveness and the bliss of that, but also seeing the exquisite beauty and yumminess of being here, of being in form with all of the pain and attachment. I think many of us know that place in various ways. I think it was Julian of Norwich called it wanting. I don't know if that's quite what wanting is, but that's my thought of it. Anyway, when I came back, I was so excited. I was like, I don't want to miss a minute of this life. I want to give up all those habits of thought that have me hanging out in like petty disappointment or irritations or misunderstandings or playing small, to just be present and love all of it. And I found myself wanting to like call up people from my past who have either disappointed me or I've disappointed them or both, and just be like, hey, let's stop locking each other in these thought forms. But, you know, I didn't, because part of it is also relishing in what is, the loneliness, the boredom, the discomfort. And I think that's the underlying message of this episode. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's just being with whatever allows us to drop into that intuitive, sweet heart. Anyway, I hope you will come and share your experiences that open you up at our next Ram Dass Soul Pod meeting. It's where we build community. And someone recently told me something they had heard about how do you build healthy community? I'm not sure where it comes from, but the answer was, you share a little of your story, you hear a little bit of someone else's story, you dance, and you sing. And we probably won't be dancing, but we will be doing the rest. And so come be a part. The information for it is in the show notes. Also, one more thing of that death-like experience was just wanting to take really good care of this form. And that means taking good care of my nervous system, which means giving up coffee again, which often results in just this afternoon irritation. A friend of mine calls coffee anger in a cup. And so again, I'm leaning more heavily on this amazing drink we've told you about many times called Magic Mind. So if you want sustained energy levels without those coffee jitters and mood swings, check it out. It has green tea and just this amazing array of plants and called adaptogens. They're just profound allies. So you can get 50% off your subscription in the next 10 days. You go to magicmind.com/Ram Dass and use the code Ram Dass. So we thank all of our sponsors, because without them, we could not bring you this podcast. And also to you who donate, we can't do it without you. So if you don't, please go to ramdass.org/donate and give. As always, we hope you are nourished by this episode and these teachings, and whatever good may come from it, may it benefit all of us in our daily lives and ripple out into the world for the benefit of all beings. Here is Ram Dass, here and now. Namaste and blessings.
About a year ago, my stepmother died of cancer, and I got a chance to nurse her during her final months. And I got a chance to, and I would, it involved catheters and milkshakes and carrying her to the toilet and changing her and lying down and holding her and just being with her. And it was a very powerful experience for both of us. Now, I watched my human heart. She was a good person. She was a really strong-willed, good person. I really admired her, and I liked her a lot. And I knew I was going to miss her terribly. And on a personal human level, it hurt a lot. And I would do anything to take away her suffering. I sat there with pills in my hands and milkshakes and anything that might help. And every time there was a pain, if I felt that my negligence had caused it, I would feel waves of guilt and anger and all that stuff. I mean, all my human stuff was hanging out there. But I watched, because I was quiet inside also with this other place. I watched the way the universe works. And I watched the way her pain, which I couldn't take away, was slowly breaking through her ego. And she'd say to me, "Rich, I don't understand this pain." She was saying, "Look, I've been a good person. Why am I suffering so?" But I watched as she got closer to death that it was like her ego, like a shell of an egg, it broke open. And what emerged was not Phyllis, it was just this being of presence, and we would be together, and there was no space. We were just floating together. And she was radiantly beautiful as she was approaching death. She didn't even know herself. It was like a whole being that had been inside her all this time, and then suddenly it came through. And when she died, she just breathed out and left perfectly quietly and clearly. And I thought, what have I just seen? It's like you've looked inside the tent and seen behind the billboard. You've seen behind it. And what I saw was that as much as I would have wished to take away that pain and suffering was like the tap that broke the shell that allowed the spirit to come forth, and she was a radiant soul. And I wouldn't have seen that, and she wouldn't have seen it. And by the time she died, it was a soul merging back into the spirit. And I thought, boy, I'd never do that to anybody, and yet it was incredible. There's a quote from Aeschylus from the Orestia. It says, "Pain falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. In our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." And that's what I saw. I saw the awful grace. And as you quiet down, you see the awful grace. You see that the things that you as a personality see as the enemy, from the spiritual you, they become the curriculum and the beautiful stuff through which you can awaken. I don't ask for pain. I mean, I'm not a masochist at a psychological level. But when it comes along, let's work with it. loneliness, fears, agitation. The other day I was speaking in Des Moines, Iowa, and I came into the hall, and it's interesting when you come into a hall, when you're, see, I to me, I'm like a renter, Ram Dass. See, I don't take myself seriously. I mean, I'm just fulfilling a role. I'm in here, but I have no form, so am I, what am I? I don't know. So when you, see, I've been in nobody training now for years. I mean, after you saw that somebody wasn't the way, you go into nobody training and you learn how to be nobody being somebody, which is different. So I came into the hall and there were people waiting and they, oh, Ram Dass. See, and you find that other people's projections turn you into something because you're not anybody. You don't have to be somebody. So they go, Ram Dass. And you go, yes. You know, it's like, okay. And so I was being Ram Dassian, you know, as I kind of came into the hall and it's, and who it was that people wanted me to be, it's sort of a warm, loving, humble seeker, you know, and I mean, I can play that. I mean, it's not that I'm not that, I'm not a hypocrite, I'm just not anything. So that's as good as any other one, you know. And so I walked into the hall being very loving and sweet. And every evening I ask that I be given one of these mini boom mics so that I can sit cross-legged and bring the mic up close. Because if it's straight mic, I've got to spend the whole evening leaning forward like that. So I walked in the hall all loving and I looked up and there was a straight microphone. And I said, I was smiling. I said, what's that? And the manager, the woman managing the hall, she said, well, that's the only microphone we had. I said, well, we ask in advance for a mini boom. And I suddenly saw myself turn into this kind of grotesque being. And I burst out laughing. Because what I saw was that my guru had come in drag as a microphone to say, try this on, you phony holy, you know. And you get to love it when you lose it. You really love it when you lose it because it shows you your secret stash. Otherwise, you don't even see the stuff. All these little uncooked seeds of desire are lurking around and fears. They're all just hanging around and you can see, you keep conning yourself into thinking you're somewhere and somewhere isn't good enough. You got to keep cleaning away and cleaning away and cleaning away. It becomes such sport to just clean away. Now, one of the things that has happened to me, despite the fact that my colleague said nothing had happened, was, and it's been a very confusing experience for me, is that I have begun to fall in love with everyone, fall into love with everyone. And it's hard to know what to do about it. See, when the armoring of the heart starts to release, like think of Mother Teresa picking up the lepers in the gutter of Calcutta. She is picking up Christ in all his distressing disguises. She's picking up the beloved in all the different forms. People say, isn't she courageous? Isn't she nice? Why? She's taking care of her beloved. What more could you want? It all depends on which veil, how you're looking at the world around you. And until you feel safe, you can't open your heart to other people. And you only feel safe when you've cultivated that part of yourself which is not vulnerable, which isn't just your separateness. As long as you think you are only your separateness, you are doomed to fear and anxiety all the time. If only the fear of death. It was an interesting sequence for me in India. When most of us grew up, the way the ego is structured oftentimes, we were trained by, in a thing that is common in psychology called conditional love. That is, our parents had an agenda. They wanted us to be good and grow up and be healthy. And so, you know, if you did stuff that wasn't acceptable to their agenda, there was a certain way, even though they love you, that they just tighten up a little. They pull in because it hurts them. So you learn not to go to the toilet on the living room floor, for example. And you learn not to say certain things. And often you learn them just with these emotional ways. Somebody doesn't say, don't do it. It's just that they get a little tight. And you develop and you get a feeling like, if people really knew me, which is Freud's point, if they really knew all my id material, they couldn't love me. And I grew up with that, a good healthy dose of that. And when I went to India and I met my spiritual teacher, he started to show me, and I couldn't hear it at first, but bit by bit he showed me what it was like to be in the presence of somebody who wasn't conditional. And you can only be unconditional when you don't want anything from somebody else, when you don't have an agenda that demands they be somebody. As long as I think I'm somebody, you have to be something or other to fulfill my somebodyness. You've got to at least reinforce or support my somebodyness. Now, he did a series of things, and just to give you a little feeling for what that sequence was, he started to show me that he knew everything that was going on inside of me. That was the beginning of it. I'll give you two episodes, because those of you that know my material, this will be very familiar to you, but think of how many times I've heard it. One of them is the Volkswagen story. One day in India, I had an old Volkswagen bus, and we were not allowed to be with my guru until the afternoon. So a number of us, about 13 of us or something like that, went in the bus over to visit a little temple, all crammed in. And on the way back, the bus wouldn't get up a hill because it was only running on 3 cylinders. So I said to everybody, get out and push. Everybody got out and pushed but 2 women who were in the back talking. They heard me, but they ignored me. So we got out and we pushed the van up the hill with the women in the back. And I kept thinking, they should have gotten out and pushed. I mean, that isn't fair. And I was sort of bugged with them, a little angry. And then we got back in the car and we went back to the temple where my guru was. And we walked into the temple and he was sitting across the yard and he started yelling, Ram Dass is angry, Ram Dass is angry. And everybody said, no, he's been very nice today. And he said, no, Ram Dass is angry. The women wouldn't get out and push. Okay, that's episode 1. Episode 2. This happened earlier, actually. I think I wrote this in Be Here Now. I'm not sure. I had been, as I said, I've been up in this temple, and I had been fasting and meditating and doing breath control, and I had lost, I was 50 pounds lighter than I am, all bones, and I really looked like a yogi. Light was pouring out of my head. I had lots of beads, a long beard. I had a dress. I was wearing a potato sack. I was barefoot, and I had these big pupils, and I was really, you know. And I had been silent for 4 months. I hadn't talked. I had written on a slate, so all that energy was like... And I was sent to New Delhi to get my visa extended. So I took the bus to New Delhi. It's about 8 hours. And I walked through the streets of New Delhi barefoot with my beads. And I was really out there. And I was so far out there that when I went into a stationery store to get some envelopes, they wouldn't take any money from me because I was obviously so holy. Which I was and I wasn't. I mean, you know, it's partly it was true and partly it's showbiz. I mean, I like being that person. So I finished my work and I went to a lunch at a vegetarian restaurant, which was appropriate for a yogi. And they were all watching me because I was so yogic. And they gave me a booth and there was a wall here and people there. And I ordered appropriate thali of a vegetarian meal and I ate it in the yogic fashion. I mean, you've got to look when you're a yogi, like you don't really want it, but you'll do it to keep the body together so you can do it. I mean, there's a whole routine, you know, a certain look you get, you know, so I ate very yogically and everybody's smiling and I'm smiling and I feel, you know, I'm doing my part and it's all partly true and I'm doing fine until dessert comes. And dessert are these two big cream-filled biscuits, which I know are not yogic food. And they know it too. And clearly what I should do is go, you know, throw them away or give them to the dog or something. But see, inside me there is a fat Jewish adolescent. See? And he wants those cookies. I mean, that's all there is to it, man. So like in magic, where you have one hand doing something else while the other, you know, I was doing holy things with this, you know, so their attention was all here and I was moving the dish around this way. And then I was doing holy things and sneaking the cookies in this way. And I got them all in with nobody watching. I didn't lose a stitch of my yogic purity. I took the night bus back up to the mountains 8 hours and arrived the next morning, bought some apples, went to my guru, kneeled down in front of him, offered the apples. He pulled my hair up, leaned down, he said to me, "How did you like the biscuits?" Now, he kept doing these things to me. And I kept saying very glibly, you know, he knows everything, he knows everything, he knows. And then one day I was sitting in front of him, in front of his tuck at his table, and he was sitting there. He was about this far away from me. He was talking to other people, and I was sitting there, and I was thought, boy, he knows everything. Oh, my God, he knows everything. And suddenly, all of the things that you wouldn't want another person to know, it's like trying not to think rhinoceros, you know? They were pouring through my mind. I mean, all of those things, you go into the bathroom and close the door to not think, you know? There they were, and he was right here, you know? And I started to get all red, and I was covering my face because it was like being broadcast on a loudspeaker, you know? And finally, when I looked through my fingers, he was about this far away from me, and he'd stopped talking. He was just looking at me. And he was looking at me with such love. Such love. And I experienced what it was to be loved just the way I am. Not if I did this or did that. Not if I'm good. But just because I am. The same way you would love a tree. You go out in the woods and you see pine trees and fir trees and eucalyptus trees or whatever trees you see. And you don't say that pine tree should be an oak tree. You appreciate it just the way it is. But you get near people and you get into this judging mode. It should be this way. It should be that way. And he was looking at me just with appreciation of just the way I was with all of it. And I thought, what grace it would be if I could love other people that way. And what I'm finding now is that that is beginning to happen, just beginning. And I look at people and I see their beauty of yearning, of fear, of caughtness. I see them just the way they are. And then the ones that I can't love so easily become the work on myself because they're just being who they are. I mean, it's my reactions that I have to work with. I don't have to change them. I may have to change their actions by saying no. For example, I have a hard time with Caspar Weinberger. For some reason, he's just hard for me. I mean, I know why. He's not a bad guy. He's just wrong about lots of things. And I don't agree with a lot of his stuff. You know, I think he's off the wall. So I have a holy table. And I have on it at home, and I have pictures. I have Buddha and Christ, Ramana Maharshi, Mary, my guru, Caspar Weinberger. The morning I light a candle and light incense. Good morning, Christ. Good morning, Buddha. Good morning, Maharaj. Good morning, Mary. Good morning, Ananda. Hello, Caspar. Okay. I see my work. See my work, because as long as I am catching only see Casperness and don't see behind it, my mind is keeping him trapped. He can't come up for air in my presence because my mind keeps forcing him to, it reinforces in him what he's stuck in. And it's interesting to keep working on yourself until the veils that other people are caught in don't catch you. So you keep your heart open. Kabir, the poet, said, do what you do with another person, but never put them out of your heart. And I am slowly learning how to do that. If you think you're somebody doing something, then who you're with becomes somebody else. Just because you're identical. Like, here's an example. I was asked to come and see a fellow who had multiple sclerosis in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Sure, I'll go. That's what I do. I came to see him, and he was living in a very little hot cabin type. And he had poles to drag himself around the room because he didn't have use of his lower body, and he was very emaciated. When I came, he was squatting on the toilet. And so I came in and I sat down on the tub. And I've trained myself to watch my own mind, to see where I am, what I'm thinking. And I was about to look up and start my dialogue. I just sat down and I examined my mind for a moment. And I saw in there righteousness. Like I was about to do good. You know what that feels like? I'm about to help somebody with multiple sclerosis. I'm about to do good. It's like Ram Dass has come to do good. It's a subtle one, but it's, you may not be familiar with it, but it's very familiar to me. You know, I was armed in my righteousness and I was about to do good to this person. And I noticed it. It couldn't get out of it at the moment. I was in it and it was pretty there. And I looked up about to start doing good and I met his eyes. And his eyes were not, he wasn't busy being somebody with MS. He was just here. And he was here so fully, he lifted me right out of my righteousness. Just like that. And I hugged him and we kissed and then we spent 40 minutes just delighting in the extraordinary beauty of the universe, including MS and including death and, oh, how it all worked and wow, and yeah, and we were holding hands. And I left and I thought, who helped whom? He helped me escape from righteousness. I have always treasured those beings who helped me escape from the traps of my own mind. And I treasure when I am a being who can be in an environment where other people can escape from the traps they're stuck in. Because everybody takes themselves so seriously. They milk their melodrama so much. What do I need? What do I want? Is our relationship working? Am I getting a good enough? Am I getting fairly paid? Will I live? Will I die? Am I sick? Oh, my God. Yeah. It's all so serious, my God. I had another great teacher. I was invited by John Lilly and his wife, Tony, to swim with these two dolphins named Joe and Rosie. And they were at this tank in Redwood City, California, which was in a big holding tank. They were there at the time. Now they're back in the ocean. And so I went with my friend because, you know, everybody wants to swim with dolphins, or at least that's the thing, the myth, you know. It was a very cold gray day and there were no wetsuits. So I put on my bathing suit and I was standing by the tank about to go in this cold water in a gray day. And I thought, what the hell am I doing here? I mean, I know you're supposed to want to swim with dolphins, but I don't know why I want to swim with dolphins. I mean, I forgot why, you know. I mean, in the heat of, do you want to swim with, oh yeah, I want to swim with dolphins. But now here I was and, oh, well, all right. I mean, because everybody was standing around watching to see what Ram Dass was going to do with the dolphins. So whatever I did, I was going to have to smile. I knew that, see, so. So I got into the tank smiling and I was treading water and they went by me just really close in and they were big. I mean, they were bigger than I thought they were going to be. My mind was desperately trying to figure out, what do you do now? You know, I couldn't remember all the dolphin stories, you know. So then one of the dolphins was right here, Rosie. And she was hovering, I don't know what you say, finning, I don't know. She was just sort of, can't say standing there. She was there, you know, she was just there. And I was thinking, what am I supposed to do now? You know, smiling all the time. And so I figured I'll touch her. That's a good thing to do. So I reached out and I touched her, expecting she'd swim away, because in my mind she was a big fish and fish swim away when you touch them, you know. And she didn't move. And I ran my hand down her back and the skin was so soft and so sweet to the touch. It made silk look like burlap, feel like burlap. It was so incredibly soft. It was like the way when you run your hand through water, except it had just a little more form than that, but it was like caressing water, something very, very soft. And I just got completely sensual, you know, I was just, and I was still thinking, well, this is nice, and I was thinking about it all and smiling and enjoying rubbing, and I suddenly became aware that she was right there. She was receiving my touch. And that her presence was so immediate and real that my mind, which had been busy thinking, stopped at that moment. I could feel it. And I just, the minute my mind stops, the arm ring separates, and then my heart went, and I was like feeling this, ah. And it was like love, feeling of love. And that moment, Rosie flipped with her tail, and she was upright, right here, and her mouth was right here, and I was kissing her on the mouth, saying, oh, Rosie, oh, Rosie, oh, Rosie. And she was insinuating her body, and I started to get aroused, you see, and I smiling all the time, you know, and I... And I thought to myself, is this legal? Just to complete that story, she then disengaged herself and she came around under my arm. I thought, I think it would be fun to swim with her. And I grabbed her fin, but I didn't want to break it, so I didn't hold on. And she went down and it slipped off and kept doing that. And finally, I thought I should put my hand around and hold it. Her, but that's kind of coming on a little bit. But I'll do it anyway. And I did it, and she swam, and I figured it's bothering her, so I let go, and she immediately came under my arm again. She was like training me like you train a rat, you know. I mean, she was very patient till I quiet down. And so I grabbed hold, and we started to swim wildly through the tank. It was just like you would imagine it would be. And after a while, I thought, well, Rosie, see, I was just in ecstasy, and then the thought came, Rosie, you're a dolphin, but I got to breathe, you know. I'm a human. And the minute the thought emerged, she came to the surface immediately. And I took a breath, and then we swam. And every time I felt the need of breath, she'd come to the surface and wait, take a breath. And we did this for about 40 minutes. At one point, I came to the surface, and people were taking photographs, and I started hamming it up for, you know, me and the dolphins. And I forgot to take a breath. And she went under. And a couple of moments later, I thought, well, Rosie, this is it, you know, because, and she came to the surface just like that after a couple of moments. And at the end of 40 minutes, I was shaking with cold, but I didn't want to stop. It was so wonderful being in such communion with somebody. And then she shook me off and went and got Joe, and they nosed me over to the holding platform and out of the tank because they felt I'd had enough. And I felt like she had shown me that when I let go of my, when I went into that intuitive heart space, I could be with her, could be with her. And we could meet behind the forms, and I've been practicing looking behind forms. Now, I've noticed, see, once I saw that my job wasn't to push away my incarnation, but to honor it. I started to look at my life to see how to honor it, how to be an impeccable incarnate. Like, what does it mean that I'm in this body? What does it mean that I'm an American? What does it mean that I'm part of an ecosystem? I mean, how can I express my concern about nuclear proliferation and the risk of it, and the unconscionable paranoia that's rooted in it? How can I express that in a way that doesn't create more fear in the world? How can, and yet I must make a statement because I'm part of an ecosystem. I can't walk away from it. And I looked at each part of my life. How do I make a statement about that I'm a member of a family, for example? And I started to realize that I must listen very carefully to hear what my part is on Earth, because each of us has a unique predicament. We are each packaged differently, and those packages aren't error. In fact, there are no errors in the whole game, I suggest to you. And so you listen to hear why you are in the unique predicament you are, if there's no error. With all of it, as many weirdities and neuroses and all that stuff, there are no errors. Each person has an optimum set of experiences through which you can grow from a spiritual point of view. From a psychological point of view, we all complain bitterly. I'm talking about the spiritual entities now. Now, I've done quite a bit of meditation, and I had been doing a very intensive meditative practice at one point. And I came back to the States, and the opportunity was there. It turned out that my father needed help. He was old and very frail, and I was unmarried, and I could do that. So I moved home to his house to help him. And for several months, I was taking care of him every day, helping my stepmother out at that time. This is a few years back. And it became interesting to me because I was used to observing my own mind. The routine with my father every morning was very straightforward. Each morning I'd come up and I'd wake him, take his blood pressure. He's had some minor strokes, so he is very quiet inside. He's not paralyzed, but he's quiet. I get his feet over the side of the bed, get him up, get him onto the walker, walk with him into the bathroom, take off his pajamas and sit him on the toilet. We brush teeth and stuff, then get him into the shower, soap his body, wash his body with a hose, dry him, wash his hair, dry him, dress him, sit him down, put on socks, shoes, comb his hair, get him on the walker, walk into the kitchen, prepare his breakfast, offer him breakfast, he eats, give him, clean up the dishes, give him his insulin shot, prepare his pills, take him into the, on his walker into the other room, get him in his chair, get him quilt over his legs. Each, that operation took about an hour and a half each day. I noticed that each day when I would come up, I noticed in my diary, which I was keeping then, that each day I would come with a slightly different scenario in my mind. Like one day I would come up, and in my mind, I was the good son taking care of dear old dad. That's where my mind was. And everything fit in. It's like you're shooting a movie. And there's dear old dad, and I'm the good son. Hi, dad, you say is a good dear son. Let's go, and you go through the whole thing. Then another day, I noticed in my diary that I was busy downstairs, and I had some phone calls to make, and I was impatient, and he seemed daughtery to me. And he was irritating. Dad, could you walk a little faster? It was a whole different model in my head. It was another day when I came up that I was in my Dr. Kildare number. I had a stethoscope on to test his heart. And I was seeing him, I was in my scientific mode, and I was seeing him as a set of ambulatory variables, really. Because with older people, the intestinal tract gets fascinating, you know, you become fascinated with what goes in and where it stops and how do you get it out. And he's not going to tell me, so you start to study it, you know, and you give him a little of this and a little of that, and you measure what comes out, and it's small, medium, large, and wow, and there's blood pressures and blood sugars and all kinds of wonderful things. And you just see, it's like what many doctors must see when they see people. They just see tubes and canals and processes, and things go in, things come out, and you measure it all. And then another day, I was like a spiritual teacher helping my father through the transition. Dad, aging is just relatively real. Now, you got to understand that my father has known me for years, and to him, I'm rum-dum. Or I was. Okay. So he's put up with all this stuff before, and all he's doing each morning is he gets up and he shuffles into the bathroom and he sits and he shits and he showers and dresses and eats and sleeps. Me, I'm writing movies every day. See, I've got these storylines that I'm living out. And I begin to be aware after several weeks that I'm never with my father. I'm always in my head about the whole thing. I'm always living out a scenario. I'm always in my mind, and my mind is always one thought away from where the action is. Because the mind is always in dualism. You're always thinking about something. So I'm never with my father. I'm always thinking about being with my father. And after a while, I quiet down. And there are some of these days where there is just walking, sitting, washing. There's just washing. There's not me washing, me as good son washing, me washing this variable, me, you know, is not all this stuff. It's just washing and combing and walking. And when I quiet down enough to just be in the act, there's Dad right there. And at the moment, just like with Rosie, we are right there together. We are in love. We are sharing the same space of awareness at that moment. And we're walking into the kitchen and we're just walking and I'm in bliss, just present. Dad, are you content? Very, he said. Me too, I said. And there was just a sweet presence about it. My brother said to me, great the way you take care of Dad, which means he doesn't want to do it. See, and I'm, because it's a brother and you've got old karma and I'm going to get a few points, I say, well, somebody's got to do it. You think I'm going to tell him it's the highest thing I do all day? You know, am I some kind of a weirdo? Am I really enjoying taking care of my father? Yes. And I see that each thing that is offered to me, pleasant or unpleasant, I don't want to talk too long. I was in a railway station in India once. So I took my shawl and I found a little piece of railway station, the big hall to sit in. And everybody else did too. And they all had their belongings and their goats and their chickens and their babies. And everybody was vomiting and peeing and drinking tea and living life. I mean, it was just a rich, a railway station in India is just like life. It's just, there it is. It's all out front. People are dying there, everything. It's all right there. Nothing's hidden in India. It's all out front. And it was, and I also had diarrhea, dysentery. And I was barefoot. And I had to go to the latrine. And the latrine had not, it had overflowed probably several weeks before. And there were a lot of flies. And I had to walk over feces to find a place to squat. And now, I grew up with a lot of toilet training. And my parents told me that if I wasn't good, I'd end up in a situation like that. And there I was in it. And when I sat down, I suddenly realized that I was happy. And I thought, this is impossible. I was told I would not be happy under these circumstances. And I was happy. And I realized, well, if I'm happy here, what am I worried about? See? It's interesting how we fill our minds with so much fear all the time. Like, for years I collected memorabilia, like old love letters and old pictures of people, the stuff you put in the attic or in the basement, you know. And I'm a wanderer because it's part of my spiritual tradition. I mean, my guru would live in the jungle all the time. He was used to be known as Cracked Pot Baba for a while. And he was naked and he'd just pick up a piece of cracked pot that somebody had discarded and put it on his head, because in India they make pots out of earth and then it goes back into the earth when it breaks. And then he'd use it for water or begging, and then when it would break, he'd put another one on his head. And so he was really down to the minimal things, you know. I still have a Master Charge card and a Volvo, and I mean, I'm in training, but I haven't gotten very far. So every time I move, I have all these boxes. See, I had all these boxes, and I label them, and they're things from the 60s, all important documents and stuff, old license plates from cars, and things you can't bear to be parted from. And so every time I would move, it's like there'd be this UPS truck behind me carrying all my boxes, and I never opened them. I just kept adding to them. And I realized that it was with the assumption that at some point, I mean, I never had time to open them because life was so rich, but I apparently expected that I would run out of life. I mean, later, there'd be nothing happening, and I'd be so happy to look at old slides of the Grand Canyon, for example. But I have now lived in monasteries where I've sat in a cell for 2 months with nothing, with no books, with no nothing, and I've been fulfilled, and my mind has filled the room absolutely full. I mean, there was no problem about that. And even boredom is fascinating if you don't react against it. I mean, most people, I'm bored. What am I going to do? Call somebody, turn on the television, read a newspaper, read a book. You don't have to be bored. How about just being bored? Did you ever really appreciate boredom? It's just, boy, am I bored. Nothing's ever going to happen. Oh, is this boring? Instead of reacting to it, you just sit with it. Okay, so I'm bored. Now what? Nothing. Well, still bored? Yep. It's going to go on for the rest of life. Here we are. Now what? Well, I guess I'll have to be bored. Okay. And you open into a whole other realm. All the time you've been frightened of boredom. And suddenly, okay, so I'm bored. So what? And there's a certain liberating quality. And the minute I saw that even very little was enough, the Bareilly railway station or the cell in my monastery in Burma was enough, I thought, what am I carrying all these boxes for? I mean, I have to buy storage space. I've got to, what for? So I decided to get rid of them all. So I threw them out, but I found in the middle of the night I was out going through them. Because I'm never going to see that picture again. So I decided to burn them. So I dramatically, each one I'd say goodbye and I'd throw it in the fire. Well, I had 15 boxes and I'm down to 6 now. See, I'm not completely free. I'm not to the cracked pot yet, but I'm edging up on it. Because you begin to see that the moment is so rich with all of it, with all of it, with all of it. That thing I was saying about boredom. As you quiet your mind just a little bit, you get so that you're not automatically reacting to everything. You become what's called responsive rather than reactive. In other words, something happens and there's a moment when it's just happening. You're just with it. And let's see if I can describe it. As your awareness expands to include more than your separate self, it's as if you're part of the gestalt of it all, and you experience the totality of it, and then out of that quietness comes an act that is appropriate to that moment. Like at this moment, even as I'm lecturing, I'm sitting in here very quiet. I'm aware of you. I'm aware of the cars going by. I'm aware of the time. I'm aware of all of it. I'm just sort of sitting here, tuning, feeling. I'm not going to push too hard. And, you know, we're exploring together, and it's all a process going on. And I'm very quiet inside, listening at the same moment I'm talking. And that's allowing me to be responsive so that my actions are not just automatically reactive against everything. Because if I'm busy being somebody, then I react all the time. Let me read you a story out of this excellent book called How Can I Help by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman. I wouldn't tell you it was good if it wasn't. You know. This is a story of, told by an Aikido master. Aikido master, that's a martial art, Eastern martial art. A friend named Terry Dobson. And this shows reactive and responsive. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty. A few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore laborer's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed the metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I'd been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even went so far as to cross the street to avoid the chimpira, the pinball punks who lounged around the train station. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized the chance to focus his rage. Aha, he roared. A foreigner, you need a lesson in Japanese manners. I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. All right, he hollered. You're gonna get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, "Hey!" It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. "Hey!" I wheeled to my left. The drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer as though he had a most important, most welcome secret. Come here and talk to me, he said. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, "Why the hell should I talk to you?" The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. "I've been drinking sake," the laborer bellowed back, "and it's none of your business." Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. "Oh, that's wonderful," the old man said. "Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we take our bottle of sake and we go out and we sit on the bench in our garden. We watch to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My grandfather planted that tree. We've been very concerned about it after the ice storms we had last winter. But you know, it's done wonderfully, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil." He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said, "I love persimmons too." His voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "Nah," replied the laborer. My wife died. Very gently swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself. Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. My, my, he said, that is a difficult problem indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it. I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with love. I had just seen Aikido in combat. Now, you can hear the difference between the old man and how hard it would have been for most of us in the presence of that violence not to be reactive. And yet, if we are reactive, all we do is compound the problem. It's like the nuclear bomb is absolutely off the wall. And it creates in us as separate entities a sense of fear and urgency to do something before something horrible happens. But if we act with fear, we feed into the culture of fear. And fear is the root cause of the bomb in the first place. So it's like you're fighting a symptom but feeding the cause. So it forces you to work on yourself to find that part of you that is not vulnerable and speak from that place. And honor the part of you that isn't separate, that isn't born, that doesn't die, that isn't coming, that isn't going. It just is. And meet others as just is. And then you listen to hear your form of manifestation and you do what you can. And what you do is, as you get into that space where you're connected with everything, then all the suffering and all the joy, my many faces, let me hear, name me, let me hear my names, as Thich Nhat Hanh said. It's all part of my body. And then my helping another suffering, it's not me doing it for them. We are part of a process. Who's suffering? Who's helping? It's like if my hand pulls my other hand out of the fire, this hand doesn't have to say thank you. It's all part of the same body. As long as you don't acknowledge you are part of the human body or of the sentient being body or of the earth body or whatever you want to say, you close down your heart. As long as you close down your heart, you don't receive the food you need as a spiritual entity to keep your life living truth. And what you see in our culture are people who are in their minds with their hearts armored, and they are so hungry, they are greedy. That's what greed comes for. And they just figure, if I have a little more, it'll be enough. I'm so hungry, and they eat more, and they collect more. If I have a bigger car, if I have a bigger home, if I have more bank account, if I have more, somehow this hunger will be fed. But the hunger is the result of the fact that they have cut themselves off from the life juice that comes from being part of the universe. And it's interesting, in our zeal to protect ourselves, we end up starving ourselves. Isn't that bizarre? And so we learn finally that we have to cultivate that quality of compassionate action towards other people as vitamins for ourselves, not just for them. Because as long as you think you're doing something for somebody else, it's still in the mind and you're still armored. You end up living your life from a spiritual point of view as an exercise of working on yourself through which you will awaken. You can't wait till you're enlightened to serve another. Yet if you're not enlightened and serve another, you know that at some level you're perpetuating suffering, even as you're helping somebody. But you can't wait till you're enlightened. What a paradox. So what you do is you serve others as an exercise on yourself to get quieter and freer. And the more quiet and free you are, the more your service really relieves and helps people. It's responsive, not reactive. It's an interesting journey, isn't it? Interesting journey, this one through life. And as you stop getting caught in the melodrama of body and the melodrama of personality, you begin to hear the journey of the spirit. See how to awaken through it.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at ramdas.org. We can then continue to share what Ramdas has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.